A Florida court orders a lawyer to show cause why he should not be removed from a case after taking his clothes off going through security. The Supreme Court stands up for all Americans when it takes on the national irritant, political robocalls. Supreme Court, please come to our rescue and quickly. And finally, Mackenzie and I unpack the movie Pelican Brief in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Welcome to this week's episode of Debriefing the Law. I am Joel Oster, and Mackenzie Smith is here as well. Say hi, Mackenzie.
Hello.
You are becoming less of a guest and more of a regular. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but nonetheless, I guess it means we're just trying to survive this lockdown. So let me just ask you, how are things going out there in Philadelphia? Have you had a chance to do the Rocky Run while you're on your break?
No, I'm taking it as like a sign that I need to relax more and put my feet up. So I'm not doing the Rocky Run. But, you know, things are going. I mean, it seems like we're, you know, sort of leveling off in terms of chaos and whiplash, and things are kind of settling down a little bit. People are, unfortunately, used to, you know, the way things are and being locked up. But, you know, hopefully things are moving in the right direction. And
it is killing me.
We'll get out of this mess.
It is killing me. Cabin fever. The spring is here. Tennis. And so I believe you've seen the meme that's been going around on Facebook and Instagram and other social media sites that I believe is Sir Isaac Newton invented gravity during some kind of plague and lockdown. All these people have done great things. Have you had great plans during this lockdown? I mean, besides the podcast, of course. Any other plans that you have accomplished, or have you survived that?
Yeah, no, I saw one that was like Shakespeare wrote King Lear when he was quarantined for the plague. What are you going to do? And it's like, well, I'm not going to write like the next great American novel because I'm not a writer. So stop
now,
trying to make me feel bad about myself.
You are a writer. I know you're a writer. You are a lawyer. That's what lawyers do. They write.
Yeah, but we don't write anything anyone actually wants to read.
Okay,
you know,
touche.
We just
good
write stuff to make a record. Yeah. My kids have been home, so we have been spending a lot of time together, which, you know, for better or for worse, you know, you do try to find those moments where you appreciate and cherish the time that you get to spend together. I've been taking my baby for a lot of hikes because that's one thing you are allowed to do, so that's good. But in terms of self-improvement, I feel like I generally have deproved myself, but I will share
deproved.
One thing, which, yeah.
Is that a word?
It is now.
Okay, I like it. Hey, go ahead and go get your copyright or trademark for that word before anyone else grabs it. Have you deproved yourself during this pandemic lockdown?
I've deproved myself, and I'm proud of it. I'm not ashamed to say it. But the one improvement that I've made is I have taken up daily flossing. And it
flossing?
Was one thing that I was just flossing. And it sounds so silly and so minor, but it's one of those things that, like, I never had really time to do, or if I did, I'm always too tired and rushing and putting kids to bed and then, you know, whatever. And I've just taken the time every day
wow.
to floss. And I have to say, I do feel healthier. I feel like this is a good improvement and I'm going to try and stick with it. I did not write King Lear, but I floss now. So that's good.
Before the pandemic, were you more of the, hey, I got a dental appointment here tomorrow. I better do one good power floss here today. So I'm ready for my dental appointment.
Doesn't everyone do that?
Exactly.
Let's be honest. And, really?
Well, talk about being honest. Why do they even ask us that question? The dentist hygienist will say, so have you flossed since I've last seen you? It's like a little bit of an awkward pause. Like, come on, you're in my mouth. You know the answer to that question. Why are you asking me, right? I got blood pouring out of the pores here. You know exactly how many times I have flossed, but I don't know. Maybe it's just some kind of...
They totally know. They totally know.
I know. They just want you to feel bad about yourself, I guess. No.
That's why I think so many people avoid the dentist, because you do feel like ashamed. It's like shame overcomes you.
It is.
It's a very intimate thing. Someone is like looking into your mouth and there's no hiding from reality, right?
Oh,
like there's no hiding. You can't be like, oh, I floss every day. They're like, no, you don't. Your gums are so inflamed, like you're about to drop dead.
Oh my like, goodness. Can you imagine if you were dating a dental hygienist? No.
I bet they're so like picky about who they even associate with. Like, I bet you it's such a pet peeve. I mean, I don't know like particularly, but I bet you like, if I can imagine if I were a dental hygienist, I would be like the first thing I would notice about people. And frankly, I'm happy to just be totally ignorant about other people's oral hygiene.
Oh, and
like, I'd rather not know.
And they're staring at your mouth and you're thinking, oh, they might want to kiss me. It's like, no, you got something between your teeth. Have you flossed this last week? It might be a killjoy of a moment is all I am suggesting. But yeah,
I know you're thinking there's great chemistry and all they're thinking is like stage one gingivitis.
No, it's not good. Not good. Well, that aside, we are nearing the end of this lockdown order for some of us. The end already happened a couple of weeks ago. I went out to play tennis, and I went to 20 tennis courts before I could find one to play on. That's how packed it was out there. I went by Lowe's. Again, it looked like Black Friday. But nonetheless, that is coming soon. But I want to do some highlights in the area of law. After all, we are lawyers, and the legal profession is still marching on. And so, Mackenzie, I want to talk about the perjury trap. Now, you are a former prosecutor. You put bad people away, or that's what you used to do. So I guess you could put you in the same category as the dental hygienist. But nonetheless, you like to put the bad people away. The perjury trap. So here's what the perjury trap is. And maybe I'm using this term colloquially, just in general, but it's where law enforcement is talking to you. Now, I say law enforcement. It could be the FBI. It could be the cops. It could even be a lawyer during a deposition. Whatever. You're being talked to. It actually is a federal crime to lie to an investigator. It doesn't matter what the lie is about. So they could be investigating you for, let's just say, you didn't pay all your taxes last year. But they asked you, hey, did you have an affair? Well, you don't want to admit to that, so you lie about it. Big mistake. Now you have lied to the person asking you the questions. That is a no-no, and that is an independent felony. For example, did you know that Martha Stewart was not convicted of insider trading?
I didn't know this.
Yeah. She engaged in insider trading. Maybe, maybe not. We don't know. But when they interviewed her, she lied about something. And it was the lie that they convicted her for. So that's why she spent hard time in the slammer for lying to investigators. And so the thought is, if someone is investigating you, they can get you trapped. If they can ask tricky questions. That's why people don't invite lawyers to dinner parties. They are kind of annoying to be around. But they ask you questions and maybe you answer in a way that they think is not on all fours, not all on the up and up. And so they can charge you with perjury. Now, what are you looking at? Well, that guy didn't like my answer. He's going to charge me with perjury. I got to hire a lawyer to defend myself. That's going to cost a lot of money. But here's where the investigator comes in and says, you know what? If you just rat out on someone else, if you go ahead and just say this other person did whatever it is we want you to say they did, we're going to let this perjury charge go away. So you trap them into giving a confession, and that is called the perjury trap. And this is in the news now with Michael Flynn. Newly released FBI files show that agents, it was their goal to get him to lie so they could prosecute him or get him fired. Now, I assume, Mackenzie, you never used the perjury trap in your prosecutorial duties or in your marriage or anywhere in life, but nonetheless, yeah.
No, wait, I have to take the fifth on that second one, though. Like, I'm not going to sit here on a podcast and commit perjury and lie about stuff either. So I'm not going to answer as to whether I've ever used it in my personal life. Professionally, I can honestly say I've never used the perjury trap, but you know, I was a county prosecutor. And so like most of the crimes I prosecuted were literally like on video. So, you know, I did have a couple of like very contested trials while I was there, but you know, I didn't really have occasion to, not that I would have done it anyway, but this seems like a pretty rare situation. You know, and if the people we're talking about are Martha Stewart and Michael Flynn, like, you know, where you're at a certain level, and I was certainly not at that level, but I will say, like, I'm very disappointed in Martha, and I feel like I can't trust her. Like, is she just making Betty Crocker and like peddling it as a homemade cake now? Like, it's very disappointing. So, I'm questioning everything right now.
But I'm gonna have to kick back on that a little bit, because I gotta tell you, if I could be quarantined with anyone, it would probably would be, well, outside of my wife, Martha Stewart, right? I mean, wouldn't she not be the ideal person to be quarantined with?
I mean, absolutely. Like, and didn't she, when she was in prison, didn't she like, she like cultivated a garden there? She lost 20 pounds. Like, it was like the best thing that ever happened to her. So I guess all's well that ends well. She's still doing great. She's still, you know, orders of magnitude richer than I'll ever hope to be. So no harm, no foul, I guess.
Well, and it's not just Martha Stewart or Michael Flynn. Also in the news of late was Aunt Becky. What is Lori Loughlin is her real name. I always refer to her as Aunt Becky. But yeah, in that case involving the college admissions scandal, it was revealed that, again, the investigators, the cops in that case, were pressuring key witnesses to lie about her. And so apparently lying is just going around here in the legal profession. You need to be wary of it, because the lie is sometimes worse than the underlying crime. This leads me.
That's almost always true. The cover-up's worse than the crime, right? And it just comes back to bite you. I mean, I personally am a liberal, so like, I don't have very much sympathy for Michael Flynn. You knew what you were doing was wrong. You did it anyway. Go to jail. But, you know, all things said, I agree that, you know, sometimes or oftentimes the cover-up is worse than the crime. And, you know, it's just, yeah, it does seem to be going around lately.
Now, Mackenzie, I do know that you just whispered liberal into the microphone. You do realize I can bump that audio up to a decibel 10 magnifier so that everyone can hear you proud and loudly. You are a liberal, but I don't know. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe I will not. But nonetheless, that's why I like talking to you.
I'm not ashamed.
That's why I like talking to you. No one has ever accused me of being a liberal. Maybe someday they will. I don't know. I like to think of myself as an independent, but maybe I'm just fooling myself. But nonetheless, I'll tell you what. Let's see how these liberal conservative viewpoints attach to this next topic. The topic of proper attire in the age of Zoom. And so there was this.
Let's try to politicize this as best we can.
Oh, we can do it. I know we can do it. No matter what political viewpoint you're from, we want you all to keep your pants on. Now, lest you think, where is he coming with that story? A true story. A lawyer recently went to court. I believe it was Atlanta lawyer Robert Ward. And he went to court and went through security. And they want him to take his belt off. Now, Mackenzie, do you wear belts generally?
No.
Okay, I know some people.
I don't. So I wouldn't have that problem, because I'm good. I travel light.
Yeah, you go to security, and it is annoying to take your belt off, right? You got to take it all those loops. You're holding things. You got to find some place to set things down. You're holding your pants up with the loophole. It is kind of irritating. I get that, but I have never done what he did to express my displeasure. He said, fine, you want me to take my belt off? How about my entire pants? And so, yeah, he stripped off his pants there as security, just out of his, I guess that was his way to protest. Now, Mackenzie, I hesitate to ask you this. Have you ever done that?
No. So, no. And what struck me most about this guy is he wasn't even in his, like, hometown court. He was in federal court in Florida, where he was admitted pro hoc vice. So he's not even licensed to practice in this jurisdiction. He's got a local lawyer who's sponsoring him, who went out of their way to vouch for his credibility and his demeanor.
Great point.
And, like, this is how he... I mean, if someone I was sponsoring ever did that, I mean... I don't know what I would do.
Your Honor, I did not know he was going to disrobe there at security. Trust me on this one. I am just as shocked as you are.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, the courthouse security people, they've seen it all, like, I'm sure. The only incident I can ever remember is that I got stopped at the federal courthouse here in Philadelphia because my bag, like, set off some kind of alarm in the scanner, and it was a book light, like a book to read in the dark. And they were like, what is that? Take it out. You know, I guess it looked like a weapon or something, and they couldn't like comprehend what it was. I was like, it's a book light. What is that? And I'm like, you know, if you want to read in the dark. And the guy goes, why would you ever want to read in the dark? So that was, you know, that's the closest approximation I have. But like, yeah, terrible idea. And you just don't want to take your pants off in public in general.
That's not a bad tip. It comes right from a lawyer, so I think you know what you're talking about. Well, you kind of alluded to, what is he doing? People had to vouch for him. He's not even admitted to practice in this court. And McKinsey, that actually became an issue in this case because the court, I believe a motion was filed to say, Your Honor, this guy should not even be an attorney. He is not Florida attorney material. And so on April 13th, there actually was a show cause order that was issued to this lawyer. He had to show cause why the judge should not revoke his pro hoc vice status for taking off his pants. Now, McKinsey, I got to tell you, I have never seen that kind of show cause order in my entire practice.
Yeah, no, me neither. I would not want to be on the wrong side of it. But I guess it does beg the question, like, what is Florida lawyer material? You know, like, what's the standard for that?
I have my Florida bar. I am a Florida lawyer, so you know what? We are fine. But surely we don't all do that. Though I gotta tell you, I teach this class for lawyers. It's called Wacky Cases, where I count down the craziest lawsuits in America. And for some reason, I get a lot from Texas and from Florida. And so there must be something there in the water. I am not sure. But it's not just in Florida, though. I found another situation this last week of a judge from Brazil. And he, I assume, have you been on Zoom lately?
Yeah, way too much. Yeah, yes.
Everyone's appearing on Zoom, and maybe for some, it's the first time they have appeared on Zoom. Well, this judge was working from home, as many of us are from Brazil, and he showed up on Zoom. And you know how when you show up on Zoom, you all the participants show up in Brady Bunch style. They all have their own boxes there. Well, you can go to the show notes of this podcast and see a picture of what he looked like. He decided, apparently he did not know he was going to be on video. He was not wearing a shirt. And so there he is, bare-chested. And can you just imagine what went through his mind as he looked at his computer screen going, huh, what's going on here? Oh, I see there's different, wait a second, there are pictures. Is that me? Am I actually naked on this Zoom broadcast? And he was, at least from the top up. So I assume you have not encountered anything like that?
I have not, but like, I have a couple thoughts about this.
What are they?
Number one, it's Brazil. Like, isn't it just kind of like anything goes? Like, it's like, let's just party. Whatever. Like, aren't people like mostly naked all the time in Brazil anyway? So
that's what the photographs show us, right? The
yeah, exactly.
Come vacation in Brazil.
On the internet.
Right.
It must be true. And also, you know, this guy's what, he was like 52 years old.
Right.
I think if you're over 40 in the age of Zoom, you get one mulligan, right?
Like one
you
mulligan.
Get one mulligan to figure out how Zoom works. And then, you know, but I guess also on the other side, it's like, how hard is it to just throw on your robe? Like, I've always said, I would love to be a judge. One of my life goals is to be a judge. I just want to judge people all day. I think I'd be really good at it. And also the perks are amazing. Like, you can really be wearing anything under that robe and no one knows. Like, are you cold? Put on some Uggs. Like, who's going to say anything? You've got the black robe on. It must be respected. So
right.
You know, he could have just taken 2 seconds and thrown on a robe, I guess. So, you know, whatever.
Well, I found this story on this website called Legal Cheek. And so right there, that's kind of an interesting website name considering what we're talking about here. But this is a top up, just to be clear on that. But they reported that this judge could be seen alongside four of his more formally dressed counterparts in screenshots. And then what he did was kind of nonchalantly left the scene, and he returned a short time later wearing a shirt and tie. So apparently he realized maybe this is not the appropriate attire, and so he changed to a shirt and tie, and I guess no harm, no foul. He got his one mulligan, and apparently that has not happened again. Yeah, I think a lot of us are learning some new things about life as we go through this pandemic. Speaking of new things, next week, the Supreme Court is going to be doing a new thing. Now, I know, Mackenzie, since you and I have talked about this, you are all excited about it. So why don't I let you just kind of talk about this new thing the Supreme Court will be doing next week?
So the Supreme Court is going to be live streaming its oral arguments, which is the first time in history that the general public will have access to real-time audio of oral arguments. Welcome. Typically, you have to go wait outside and pray to get in and, you know, stand in long lines and obviously travel to D.C. So you won't have to do that. You can just click a button next week and listen to these arguments. It's going to be great.
Hey, welcome to the 21st century United States Supreme Court. It's glad that you joined us. Next thing you know, they're going to be posting on Facebook and Instagram and I don't know what other sites that these people are on nowadays, but nonetheless, they are going to actually have two very interesting cases. So if you are interested in following the Supreme Court, I highly recommend you follow these cases. The first one is Barr v. American Association of Political Consultants. Now, Mackenzie, this case involves something that is near and dear to all of our hearts. We're talking about telemarketers. And so in this particular case dealt with the robocalls. Now, Mackenzie, have you ever been subject to the robocalls? Do you know what I'm talking about when I use that term robocalls?
Absolutely. And I feel like I get multiple, I don't answer them because now my question is like, what is the incentive for people to still be making robocalls? Like, does anyone actually answer these things now?
Right.
You know, in the age of cell phones, it says spam likely, or even in my case, if I don't know the number, I mean, sometimes my phone will ring. It's a number I don't know. And I literally will like Google the number really quick.
Right,
and
right.
If it's not like my bank or, you know, someone really important,
yes,
I don't answer it. I'm like, you know, if they really need me, I'll let them leave a voicemail and I'll get back to them. But most of the people who call me, I know already I have their number in my phone.
Does
so
not everyone,
I don't understand who's picking up these calls.
Yeah, does not everyone in America have caller ID? I think we all know how to use caller ID. Now, you mentioned who is answering these calls. I want to do you one better, Mackenzie, because have you ever received these robocalls where it's just some computer that's randomly calling all these numbers, and what the computer says is, hold on for someone. Who actually holds on? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Yeah. Who says, oh, okay.
I know.
You just inconvenienced me, but let me hold.
And so I did it one time. I was just curious, who in the heck is calling? I waited. It was just some telemarketer trying to sell me something. And I thought, what an idiot I am. I held on for this so that someone could then try to sell me on their product. And I then proceeded to hang up on them. But nonetheless, you make a very good point. Who is actually answering these robocalls, and are they actually effective?
I can't imagine that they're effective. I mean, I don't know. Like this case, Barr versus American Association of Political Consultants is talking about a group that wants to make robocalls that solicit political donations. Like, is anyone actually doing this?
So
if I want to make a political donation, I listen to the candidates, pick which one I like the best, and then I take the time out of my day to like go to the website, make a donation. That's all well and good. You get your bumper sticker in the mail. You don't put it on your car because you don't want to get your car keyed, because that's the world we live in.
Right, right.
But you know, I mean, I don't understand what kind of a person is sitting around, answers a spam likely, is solicited, like, we want you to give money, and actually gives money to a political candidate this
maybe
way.
Maybe this is the same person who on their 1040 form, where they have the boxes, click here if you want to donate money to the presidential campaign, Who clicks that box? Yes, I want to pay extra money to some. No, I'm not giving you more of my money. This is a tax form, but you're right. Someone is apparently responding to those. Well, you brought up the issues. Let's just unpack the actual legal issue in this case. The first thought here is there is a federal law. I believe it came in 1991, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, and it prohibited automated calls. It prohibited the robocalls, and this is 1991. To which my response, McKinsey, was, really? Robocalls have been illegal since 1991? Apparently, a lot of people have not gotten the message. Does that surprise you? Right. These have been illegal since 1991?
I mean, yeah, it's very surprising to me. I feel like, you know, I've been getting them forever, for as long as I can remember, and they don't, yeah. They certainly didn't stop in 1991, let's put it that way.
No, I've been getting them nonstop, especially political ones, so it's kind of surprised me that this was somehow, was prohibited or outlawed by a federal law. Well, there are some exceptions to this federal law. One exception would be if you had already agreed to it. Another exception that came out, I believe, in 2015 was for debt collection, if the debt collector was from the federal government. And so that was the law. Well, as you pointed out, these people who are trying to campaign and do some campaign robocalls wanted to challenge this law. And so they filed a lawsuit saying that this law, with these exceptions, is a content-based speech restriction. McKinsey, what do you think? Do you think this law actually restricts speech based upon the content of the message? What is the argument that is being made here?
Right. So you can't, you know, generally you can't impose content-based speech restrictions. And I think the argument of the political consultants who want to robocall is this exception, the government debt exception, is a content-based restriction, meaning if the robocall is about government, you know, debt that the recipient of the call owes to the government in one way or another, then, you know, that content of robocalls is okay, but any other kind of solicitation or any other kind of robocall is not okay. Now, the interesting argument, I think, on behalf of the government is the government made an argument in its brief that said this isn't a content-based restriction,
right?
Because if I have a robocall that says you need to pay your money, then, you know, it's okay if it's a government debt and it's not okay if it's just a regular debt. So, you know, it's not really content-based. It really, what it depends on is, you know, whether the characterization of the debt, I guess, and not the content of the communication itself, I thought was a very creative and interesting argument.
It is a very creative argument. So in other words, it's not the content of the message we're concerned with. We're concerned with the kind of debt. Now, this calls into question this case called Town of Gilbert v. Reed, came out of the Supreme Court a few years back. And in full disclosure, I actually worked for the law firm that litigated this case. Now, I was not involved in this case, but I was working for the law firm when this case came up. And this case involved signage, and there were signs that were put about town. And this town prohibited signs that were for advertising church services, but it did allow for other signs like real estate signs and things like that. And so the argument was made in Town of Gilbert v. Reed that in order to tell what sign was allowed and what sign was not allowed, you had to read the content of the sign to make that determination. And so the court agreed with that argument and struck down those laws that prohibited church signs. So this case is going to deal with, do we extend that reasoning here? In other words, you have to listen to the content of the message to determine whether or not this prohibited call is outlawed. And so that is going to be an issue the court has to deal with. Now, McKinsey, why is this important? Why is it important to determine that this is a content-based speech restriction?
Because the level of scrutiny that you apply to the law changes depending on whether it's content-based. So
okay.
If it's not a content-based restriction, then it's like rational basis, whatever, the law is going to get upheld. But if it is content-based, then strict scrutiny applies, and it's very, very difficult for a law to pass strict scrutiny because it has to be narrowly tailored to protect a compelling government interest, which interestingly, the district court, the trial level court in this case, found that it was a content-based restriction, but that the law was still constitutional because the government has a compelling interest in collecting on its debts. So that content-based carve-out is acceptable under the First Amendment, to which I say, IRS, right, you can mail me my tax refund right now because of my compelling interest in collecting the money that you owe me and that I've given you as an interest-free loan for the past 12-plus months. Thank you very much.
Wow. And you call yourself a liberal. That is the most conservative thing I think I've ever heard from anyone. Hey, government, you've had my money for too long, and now you have to have a compelling governmental reason to keep my money. You don't have one. Give my money to me right now. So, hey.
Maybe I'm an independent, too. I mean, this is great.
I'm telling you what, we're meeting in the middle. It's going to be a fascinating case. Again, you'll be able to listen to the oral argument next week, and then we expect a decision sometime in June, though maybe that's up in the air as well, as the court is a little bit off their normal schedule. All right, well, a second case that came that's going to be discussed next week is called Little Sisters of the Poor v. Pennsylvania and the Trump v. Pennsylvania. So, Little Sisters of the Poor. Now, Mackenzie, have you ever heard a better name for a case than Little Sisters of the Poor? I mean, how can any court rule against the poor little sisters of the poor?
I know. It seems intentional to me. I don't know. I mean, it definitely invokes some empathy, for sure.
Yeah, you're not going to rule against them, and I'm sure it was intentional. I'm sure they picked that group for a reason to be the test case. Well, nonetheless, this issue, it involves an issue that I think a lot of people are very concerned with, though the actual legal issue in this case is not really that exciting. So the big issue here, if you will, is the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, if you will. It required employers to provide birth control for their female employees. And so that was the law at play. Well, the administration's changed hands. Now you got President Trump, and they basically said, yeah, this is the law, but we are not going to interpret this law in such a way that infringes upon an employer's religious beliefs and practices. Now, before, there was a Supreme Court case before that said that this law cannot be applied against religious organizations to violate their religious beliefs, but it was an open issue as to non-religious organizations, just general corporations, and so that's the context in which this case came up. So what are your thoughts about this case?
So I think this is actually a really good example of a case where you can have a political belief, right? And people do have strong political and personal, like you can have a personal belief. You can have a strong personal belief about the policy behind the law and what the organization is doing and whether the religious beliefs asserted are really sincerely held or, you know, right, whatever. There's a whole discussion to have about it. But this is a great example of one of those cases where it's really about a quote-unquote technicality, right? Like, it's about a procedural issue. And on the procedural issue, sometimes you fall on the other side to where your personal beliefs might be. So the actual issue in this case is whether the government followed the proper procedures for making this interim rule change, I guess. Typically, when an administrative agency makes a rule change, there has to be a notice and comment period, right, which means they publish like a proposed rule. People are allowed to read it, make comments, and then they kind of take those into account and then publish the final, or allegedly take right, them into the account, I guess, and then publish the final rule, which wasn't done here because it was an interim change. And I don't know what the proffered reasoning was for not giving the notice and comment period. But in any event, in the statute itself that Congress passed, there's really no like recourse if that procedure isn't properly followed. And I guess it's pretty undisputed here that the procedure was a little bit messed up. They gave a notice and comment period, but after the interim rule was already in place, so it was kind of just like a formality,
right.
But it wouldn't have changed anything about the rule. And the statute, which governs what the administrative agency can do, doesn't say that the rule is invalid. In fact, it says the opposite. The rule is still valid, even if they don't follow the procedure. So, you know, regardless of what my political or personal beliefs are, or anyone else's, like, it seems pretty open and shut here. And you have to try to be intellectually honest, and the law says what it says. So, right. You know, that's where I come out on this.
So let's unpack the legal issue, because as you pointed out, in 2017, this current administration wanted to make an interim change regulation was played out, and so they failed to offer the proper notice and comment period of time. That's pretty much unquestioned in this case. And I will say that if you challenge an administrative rule by saying you did not follow your proper procedures, you're going to get that rule stricken. It's going to be thrown out because you didn't follow the necessary steps. All right, we have that, but now you have 2018, and now they're going to go for a permanent change in the rules, not an interim change in the rules, a permanent change in the rules. And for the permanent change, they did do the proper notice and comment. They did have do the proper notice and have a proper comment section. So the issue in this case is, does that fix the problem, or is it a little bit too late? And so that's the issue the court's going to have to address. I don't really have a good feeling on which way the court's going to go, one way or the other. But hey, tune in next week, and maybe we will have a good feeling after we hear the Supreme Court's argument. Which, Mackenzie, leads us all to our Pelican Brief Review. We've been having a lot of fun over the last month or so watching different legal movies. Let's see. We started off with My Cousin Vinny, right?
Yes.
And then we went to, what was the next movie?
I think we did Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, that's right. Then Liar, Liar. And this
week,
are doing Pelican Brief. And so I am enjoying watching all of these movies. And one of these weeks, we're going to have to do the new one. There is a new movie out right now, I think, called Just Cause. Have you heard about that movie?
I haven't, but I'm willing to like watch anything. I'm actually really, you know, I don't consider, or until recently, never considered myself like a huge movie buff. And it's funny. I used to watch so many movies, you know, when I was younger, and life kind of gets the better of you sometimes, and you get busy, you're building a career, and then you have a family, and it's hard to dedicate two and a half hour block of time. But this, you know, quarantine period has been such a great opportunity to get back into watching movies. And, you know, some movies are better than others. Some movies are more legally accurate than others.
Right.
What a joy to be able to sit down and kind of be transported into another world for a couple hours. It's really like a ton of fun. I've been really enjoying it.
Well, this was an action-packed thriller, a John Grisham novel and movie. It was made in 1993. And the basic plot of the movie is you had two Supreme Court justices. So as the movie is just starting out, you see these two Supreme Court justices. One was named Jensen and the other one was Rosenberg. Now, I don't think we know that much about these justices, but in the movie it does say that these two judges were on opposite sides of the aisle on most questions. I think one was a conservative and one was a liberal. So think maybe you have Scalia on one side, and on the other side, you're going to have a Breyer. So two opposite type of justices, and they were both murdered at the beginning of this movie. Well, there was a Tulane Law School student named Darby Shaw, played by Julia Roberts, and she decided to do a little bit of research into this, why these justices might have been murdered. And so then she wrote a brief on her theory as to why they were killed. And then the rest of the movie just kind of plays off on who got a hold of this brief, and people who read the brief ended up dying. And so apparently she was onto something. It became an action-packed thriller all the way to the end of the movie. But Mackenzie, I want to start off here because you pointed out something that I thought was a glaring plot hole to the Pelican Brief. It kind of undercuts the entire movie. What was the plot hole that you discovered?
No, what was it? I don't know. What, that people don't actually get murdered in real life?
No. The movie is called Pelican Brief. It's not even a brief.
It's not about a brief.
Yeah. No. It should be called Pelican Memo, Pelican Essay, whatever, but this is not a legal brief. Explain what you meant by that.
Yeah, so a legal brief is like I don't know what the etymology of that is or the origins of why a brief is called a brief, but a brief is a summary of the law in a given area and then an application of those legal principles to a given set of factual circumstances,
yeah.
Which is not what the Pelican Brief was about. The Pelican Brief was just a document where Julia Roberts wrote down, you know, I think this millionaire oil tycoon guy hired hitmen to murder two Supreme Court justices. There's no like principles of law that are synopsized in this document at all.
And maybe it's just how we normally use terminology in the legal profession, but I've worked for several law firms in my day. And if a partner wanted me to write up something, it's called a memo, a memorandum of law. That's what I write for that partner. Hey, here's your memo on whatever issue. When I write a brief, it's to a court. Oh, the brief can only be 14,000 words or 20 pages. And so this is definitely kind of just written by some law student. At best, maybe I would call this a memo that she was going to give to someone on this issue. I definitely would not call it a brief, nor have I heard any partner refer to this kind of writing as a brief. But I thought that was an excellent observation that you made. Now, you had another interesting observation that I totally agree with. Explain your days at Tulane.
Oh, best days of my life. Love it. Wish I had stayed in New Orleans for another decade. And, it's some of my greatest memories. It's one of the best. I've lived a bunch of interesting places. I've traveled a lot of places. And I've got to say, like, New Orleans is one of the best cities on planet Earth. It's such a vibrant place. It's awesome. And I will watch any movie that has anything to do with New Orleans. And it's just great to even, see the scenes and feel the lifestyle, and how things used to be. It's just great. And I went to Tulane for undergrad. So, I have a little bias there as well.
Yeah. Tulane. You went to Tulane undergrad. I got to tell you that you are amazing that you actually graduated after attending Tulane undergrad, because I have been in New Orleans. So this movie was based really in two places, Tulane, so the New Orleans area, and then also Washington, D.C., because, of course, of the Supreme Court. Whenever I have a CLE in New Orleans, I absolutely love it. I love going to Cafe Du Monde or Superior Seafood. I go to Drago's and have their char-grilled oysters on the half shell. Oh, it's my favorite place to be. I just love being in New Orleans. What is your favorite hangout place in New Orleans?
Oh, my gosh. There are so many. And I do have to say, I was actually this year is my 15-year college reunion.
Okay.
And so I was supposed to be going down there in a week to have a little reunion with all of my college friends. And we're so disappointed.
Oh, you're not going to do
we're
it.
Not, yeah, we can't. I mean, everything's kind of shut down and, people are trying not to travel so much. So it's being postponed. We're going to do it eventually. We're just not going to do it in the immediate future. But yeah, we have so many places. I mean, Emerald, from the high to the low, K Paul's Kitchen, Mother's. I mean, our favorite hangout, which is so dumb, but in college we used to go to the Trolley Stop Cafe, it was open 24/7. So after a night out, we would go there at 3 or 4 in the morning and have a ton of French toast, bacon, butter, grits, all the best kind of food. And it was just so much fun.
Have you been to Cafe Du Monde?
Of course.
Oh, it's my favorite place. You can just sit there and get some coffee and some beignets and listen to jazz music. So I went there. It's one of my favorite hangout spots. And there's a spot right next to where some musician is playing. It's right on the outskirts there. It's all outdoor, place to sit. And I was sitting there listening to this guy playing some jazz sax music, and I was really enjoying it. And that evening, I went to one of these concerts where these jazz musicians were playing. that same guy who was playing for like an open, you know, instrument case of cash was then performing at some nice place in the evening. So, yeah, these guys are really, really talented.
Oh, absolutely. You hear the best live music. It's just, I think New Orleans is more of it's like an outlook or an attitude that people have and their outlook on life. It's just different down there. And, you know, it's definitely different being from the Northeast. We have such kind of like a rat race mentality.
Right,
and
right.
It's very difficult for people who are born and raised in the Northeast to kind of stop and smell the roses sometimes. So taking a couple of years out of your life when you're young to kind of transplant yourself into that environment and realize, like, you know, this is a choice and
right.
you don't have to have this outlook at all times. You know, I mean, it's wonderful. I just remember being maybe 21, 22 years old, and I was walking home one morning, and there was, you know, a man who was probably homeless or worse for wear anyway. And he asked me how I was, and I said, I'm good. How are you? And he said, well, I'm just blessed. Of course,
right.
We all are. We just don't all acknowledge it. And I was like, oh, okay. We're just like spouting profundities at 6 o'clock in the morning. But that's the kind of outlook that people have there. And it's so invigorating and just, it's joyful. And it's a wonderful place. Even if you, you know, are the victim of a suspected car bombing like Julia Roberts and Pelican Brief, I would still live in New Orleans.
It is a great place to be. And it's also the kind of place that has a drive-through daiquiri shop. So apparently you can drive through a daiquiri shop, get a daiquiri, and as long as the top of the straw, the paper top is still on there. That's not considered an open container in your car. I don't know how they get around that, but nonetheless, it is a very fascinating place, especially if you love music, and as I do. Well, this, again, half of this movie is based in the New Orleans area, and I loved watching those scenes where it was so crowded. Of course, my mind immediately went to, don't you know those guys have social distancing? You can't be that close to one another. This is a different world than what we're used to now, but who knows? Maybe one of these days we'll get back to that. But what did you enjoy about this movie?
Yeah, well, definitely those scenes make you crave. Like, I'm not even a person who goes out to bars a lot or has, you know, much of a social life. But when you see these scenes of Bourbon Street and the French Quarter and everyone's dancing and partying and having a good time, I'm like, oh my gosh, I just want to go out and party.
Right, right.
It really makes me want to get out. And you do sit back and think like how small all of our worlds have become recently. So, you know, that's definitely one thing that stuck with me about the movie. But also, you know, there's not that much, like the other movies we've reviewed were all courtroom dramas. There were a lot of courtroom scenes. This movie is not a courtroom drama. I guess it would be categorized as a legal thriller or a legal suspense movie, but there's not really that much legal involved in it. But the first scene is a scene of the Supreme Court. And, you know, inside Denzel Washington, who's a reporter for the Washington, I guess, Herald, it's called the movie, is talking to the Supreme Court Justice Rosenberg. And outside there are all of these protesters. And it just struck me that this movie was made almost 30 years ago. But the protesters are all protesting about gun control, abortion, and climate change. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Wow, 30 years ago.
Yes.
That could have been filmed last week.
It could have been filmed last week. It really could have.
So look in the crystal ball. 30 years from now, 2050, the big issues are going to be abortion, gun control, and the environment. You're right. The more things change, the more things stay the same. Well, you mentioned Denzel Washington. So he played a reporter there, and his name was, I'm trying to find his name. Do you remember his name?
It began with a G.
Gray Grantham is his name.
Grantham, that's right. I mean, he'll always be Denzel to me. So
that's
like,
right.
Whatever.
We refer to him as Denzel Washington. Well, so the whole premise of this movie is that you have these two Supreme Court justices who were murdered. And Darby Shaw, you know, Julia Roberts, wrote this memo, let's call it, and she came up with a theory that apparently struck some nerves there in D.C., and her theory was, there was this rich oil tycoon. His name was Victor Matisse, and he had a case that was going through the courts, and he wanted to drill for oil under some of this New Orleans, Louisiana lands, marshlands. But this particular marshland was a habitat for an endangered species of a brown pelican. That's where you get the name of the movie, Pelican Brief. And so he filed a lawsuit to be able to drill for his oil there. And it was going through the court system. And he expected this to reach the U.S. Supreme Court and thought that he needed these two justices out of the picture so that way he could be successful on his case. So what do you think of that as a trial strategy? I'm not suggesting, I want your opinion whether or not we should murder judges. I'm pretty sure I know what your opinion would be on that. But just in general, what do you think of that as a premise for a movie? Is that strike some kind of nerve that you have about how our system operates?
You know, it's funny because it's so, the whole plot of this movie, I just remember watching this movie many years ago, like long before I ever went to law school and became a lawyer, and being so, you know, it was so suspenseful and thinking right. It was so thrilling watching this movie. And now watching it from my perspective now, I'm like, this is ridiculous. This would ever happen. I don't feel on the edge of my seat. I appreciate Denzel and Julia Roberts.
Right.
And Stanley Tucci, by the way, who's like the assassin in this case, young Stanley Tucci. But you know, it's so ridiculous. However, I do think, you know, upon watching it in the climate that we're in these days, it does show you like that there can be just one or two justices, especially, but really judges at any level, that can really change people's lives and, you know, have a huge impact on our culture and, you know, certain decisions and the way we live our lives as Americans. And this is a phenomenon that has occurred, you know, throughout our history. I mean, if you go back to, you know, Dred Scott and like all of these cases where the court really at most is 9 people who have like this huge influence, but oftentimes it's only one or two of them who end up having a huge influence. And obviously it was that way for a long time with Justice Kennedy. And, you know, it's a part of our canon in the way our system kind of operates as Americans. So I don't think that's far-fetched at all. Now, I hope that, you know, that it doesn't get so far afield that people are actually considering murdering Supreme
right,
Court
right.
justices.
Yeah.
And I certainly, you know, wouldn't want to give anyone any ideas that we don't advocate that. But yeah, like people, it does, you know, there are shenanigans that have gone on and there have been accusations made on both sides very recently about filling Supreme Court vacancies. So it happens. I mean, it's definitely an issue that comes up.
Doesn't that, it touches on a nerve that our laws really are premised upon what a Supreme Court justice thinks. That's the reality of it. Their opinions change our laws. They create laws. I know they probably will say, oh, we don't create laws, but no, in a practical matter, you do create laws by striking down laws, by upholding rights that some people would disagree with. And we live in a democracy. And so a lot of people have a problem with, you know, 9 Supreme Court justices, like I said, even going down to 1, deciding these issues. You don't vote them into office and you can't vote them out. And so that is an interesting issue that, how do we select our justices, and is that process very democratic?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not the most democratic process, but I guess the thought is, and I, you know, off the top of my head, can't refer you to any Federalist Papers or anything about
right,
this, but
right.
I guess the thought is that, like, you know, by the time you're qualified to be a Supreme Court justice, hopefully you will have attained some level of moral rectitude and intellectual honesty that will inform, you know, the way you make decisions and certainly respect for the weight of your position that would inform the way you would make decisions. So, you know, who knows? And we've seen very recently that, you know, there's also an issue with stare decisis and being able to overturn past decisions that, you know, it's not, nothing's forever. And,
right. You
know, decisions do get overturned as well. But yeah, it's definitely the least democratic of the three branches of government, I would say. And I think it was designed that way for a reason. And it just, it is what it is. And the oil tycoon in this case, you know, thought that it was an election year. Okay. Another thing that we've seen happen. Right. And, you know, he thought that the president may not get reelected and the person who would get elected to replace him would appoint, you know, justices that would not, that would be more favorable to him, I guess. And so, you know, it just, he decides to murder these two justices, and that's not what, we don't want to give anyone any ideas or whatever.
Right, but
I think, you know, our system is designed so whenever a justice retires or dies in office, like, it's kind of like them's the breaks. Like, whoever is the president gets to nominate the replacement. I mean, that's just the way it works.
Well,
so
let's talk about
that. You kind of have to take your lumps.
Right, let's talk about that, because I do think that there should be some kind of either written rule or unwritten rule that if a justice or a judge is murdered while in office, then the replacement needs to be someone of like mind and spirit. In other words, someone of the same ideological background. Whoever is sitting in that particular governor's position or the president's position should not take that as an opportunity to advance their own political agenda, and they should replace them with a person of like mind and spirit. Any thoughts about that rule?
I don't you think that also invites gamesmanship in terms of, number one, like, judges not being completely forthright about the way they would rule on issues? Not that they are anyway, but, you know, also it might incentivize gamesmanship in terms of when people retire. Although I guess that kind of happens anyway as well. I mean, I don't know. I think it would be very, very difficult to expect, you know, like, an extremely progressive elected official to appoint like a staunchly conservative judge. It's kind of like antithetical to what they were elected to do as well. And
we've seen
like it is like a political strategy these days to elect certain people because of their power to appoint judges and justices, and those people shall remain nameless. I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying some people might have a strategy.
Right. I'm just telling, I have litigated in this area with controversial cases, and I can tell you on both sides, there are crazies. They are. I will tell you, I was involved in one case. I want to pause here because I don't want to say anything I shouldn't say. But let's just say I represented a client on a matter, and I read in the news that someone was shot and killed. And my first thought was, I sure hope it wasn't my client who did that, because, you know, it's you do represent some people who are kind of crazy on both sides of the issue, and I just would hate it if someone actually were motivated and to kill someone because of a political end, and they were rewarded for it by doing that. And so this movie kind of introduces that as a concept. I sure hope and pray that never actually does happen. Some part of me would like to see a rule that if someone is murdered, now we're not talking dying, right? Dying is another thing. When Scalia passed away, though I will point out that the circumstances of his demise were at least somewhat of a head scratcher, but nonetheless, I'm going to take his family at face value, saying they don't want an autopsy. It was all on the up and up. And so if someone dies while in office, then whoever is in power is allowed to appoint that replacement, however that person wants to appoint them. But if someone is murdered, I'm just wondering if we shouldn't have a different rule that you have to appoint someone of like mind. How about put it in this context? Let's say you are governor of a state and you are a Democrat. Okay. Are you envisioning that you're the governor of the state and you're a Democrat, right?
I can see it very clearly, actually.
Oh, flip it. You're Republican. I want you to imagine being a Republican, all right? You are a conservative Republican. I like that much better. All right.
I just developed an eye twitch, but that's fine. I'll do my best.
All right, it's good. And you have a senator in your state who is a Democrat, right? And you're a Republican. Someone kills that senator, that Democrat, and you have to appoint the replacement. would you appoint a Republican or a Democrat to replace that senator?
Well, I mean, unless your rule is in place, I'm appointing whoever's most like-minded to me, so I would appoint a Republican.
And doesn't that just seem wrong? That someone killed that person?
Now that you say it, yes.
Right, and let's just say this is on the eve of, I don't know, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, where it's a really important deal, it's highly contentious. You all witnessed how contentious that was. If someone actually were to murder someone, I would sure like, even if it went against my political viewpoint, that whoever they replaced him with was of like mind and spirit to whoever was murdered. I don't know, just something about me would like to see that as a written or unwritten rule. All right, well, let me...
You know, maybe that's a really good point. And I think, like, one thing we can take away from the Pelican brief is, like, at least we're not there yet. I mean, at least we're not there. People lament the state of political discourse all the time, but, like, we are not, knock on wood, majorly, but, like, we're not there to where, like, people are actually thinking about assassination as a valid, like, political technique, so that's good. But maybe we could let elected officials have, like, a secret document where they get to name their own successor if they're murdered, and that could be the rule, and no one knows who it is because it's kept in like a locked safe somewhere at the Capitol, and so it wouldn't do any good because that person had already chosen their own replacement in the event of assassination.
In my last will and testament, I leave my position, if murdered, to the following. Yes, I kind of like that idea. All right, well, let me have you, you're going to get the last word here. This movie, are you going to object to it, or are you going to admit it into evidence as being one of the contenders for the Hall of Fame of greatest legal movies ever? What do you think? Is this objectionable, or is this something we can admit?
So, yeah, I mean, this like breaks my heart, but I have to object to it because not only is there not very much like legal material in this movie, and you know, they're murdering Supreme Court justices, which I don't, you know, right, I have a problem with in general. But the movie title like kind of does it a disservice. It's not about a brief. I feel misled.
That is a great pickup.
Yeah, and there's too many car bombs. Like, there aren't that many car bombs in real life. I mean, I don't know if it was like a 90s thing that people did. But yeah, so I'm much more in favor of keeping it a little bit realer than this. And I didn't feel like that thrilled by it. Although I will give a shout out to the scenes in New Orleans and, you know, the great acting. There was a lot of good acting. But in terms of legal dramas, I object.
I would agree with that. I thought were several plot holes. You mentioned one, it's not even a brief, it's a memo. But then secondly, I'm not sure I bought into the premise of the movie. I mean, why would you kill all of these people who are even remotely involved? I thought the advice of the president's advisor at the very beginning was the best way to go. Do you remember that one where, I forget the guy's name, but he was the bad guy in Ghost in that movie? He was the president's advisor. And he said, look, here's one way we can handle this. Just let the brief come out and then appoint someone who is appoint someone who's an environmentalist, someone of like mind and spirit as to the murdered justices, appoint them, and then conduct an investigation into Matisse and his group. I thought that was great advice, that he should be a lawyer. That's how they should handle this. The situation would have been resolved. The president would have came out smelling like a rose, and I'm not sure why the president went the other direction. Which you could say, well, he did it because this guy, Matisse, gave $4.2 million to the president in his campaign, which I thought was another plot hole. I am not sure in 1993 that you could give $4.2 million. Keep in mind, this is before Citizens United, and so I'm pretty sure that level of contribution, even if done through a political committee, would not have been allowed under the rules. But nonetheless, that was another, at least to me, a plot hole. I think that's a plot hole. You would not be able to give $4.2 million pre-Citizens United. So I would agree with you.
Good point. Like, shouldn't the president have been concerned about his glaring campaign finance issues?
Right. No.
Yeah, so not good all around. And yeah, the president in this movie did kind of seem like a bumbling idiot. Like every time something happened or someone else got murdered, he'd be like, oh no, it's like, have some agency, like make a decision.
Right.
Yeah, so it is what it is. But I'd still like to have a daiquiri in honor of this movie. You know, it is what it is.
Once you get to New Orleans, you can do that. You can go through the drive-thru. Just don't take the straw off until you... I have no idea when you can take the straw off, but nonetheless, I will say one of the nice parts, or at least premonition parts of this movie, was where the president was talking to the FBI director and saying, I want you to stop investigating this, this matter. And so I thought that's pretty interesting in light of the whole Russia collusion thing, and can the president direct someone to stop investigating a certain matter? I thought that was somewhat of an interesting legal issue that they were well ahead of their time with, but nonetheless, that didn't really seem to play out in this movie. So I agree with you. This is not going to be entered into the Hall of Fame of greatest legal movies ever. Next week,
no My Cousin Vinny. Let's put it that way.
Not even close. Yeah, I'll watch My Cousin Vinny 100 times. But I will tell you this: it is nice to be old. You have not reached that age yet, but I will tell you that one of the perks of being old is you can go back and rewatch older movies, and you forgot how they went. And so I watched this movie. I'm sure I had seen it before, but I didn't really remember too many of the scenes. All right.
That's so funny. I mean, I didn't really remember it that well either, other than, you know, New Orleans, Tulane, and I remember being thrilled before, but once you know how the world works, it's kind of a letdown.
Well, there you go. That is Pelican Brief. Next week, let's come back and let's unpack the movie Just Cause. Are you up for going over a new movie?
Absolutely.
All right, let's do Just Cause, and we'll see you next week.
Sounds good.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess. Our marketing team, Redbird Solutions, and Leanne Holmberg, for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.